Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hi there, it's Justin Brierley. Welcome to another classic replay from Unbelievable. We've been bringing you these conversations for a long, long time, over a decade and a half. In fact, we recently celebrated 16 years. A really special one for you today. Good memories of this one, actually, in this show from August 2011, when we met Rebecca Benich, who lives in Saskatoon, Canada. She grew up in a strong Christian family, but in 2007 came out as an atheist. Well, I got her in conversation with Sheridan Voisey, a writer, speaker, and broadcaster, and they discussed what led Rebecca to abandon her faith, how Christians can best treat their friends who walk away from faith, and what lessons can be learned for fruitful dialogue. So, hope you enjoy this one. Don't forget, you can keep up to date with the latest from the show, get in touch, and find many more debates at our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, welcome along, both my guests today. And let's first of all turn to Rebecca, who joins us on the line from Canada. Rebecca, thank you very much for getting in touch with me a little while ago. Tell me, how did you first bump into the show, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, you know, one of my favorite things to do, to listen to actually when I'm doing housework or on my iPod when I'm outside walking, I love to listen to debates. I love to listen to Christians debating non-Christians. And so I found out about Unbelievable on a blog that I read. So I've been actually listening to the show now. I've been trying to think how long, at least 2 years. And so it's really exciting for me to actually be on the show. I feel like I almost know you, Justin, because I've listened to so many episodes.
Well, that's very kind. You described it to me as a guilty pleasure. Why a guilty pleasure?
Well, you know, it's. I think a lot of my atheist friends and colleagues, I don't think they quite understand why I'm so drawn to it, but I've always appreciated the approach the show takes in terms of the amount of respect given to both sides. So I look forward to it every week, and so it is a bit of a guilty pleasure. I guess I suppose I part of me thinks I shouldn't be as excited to hear theology being debated, but I really quite enjoy it.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us anyway, and I'm so glad you did get in touch. And we'll, of course, put details of your blogs, loads of different things you contribute to, actually, Rebecca, but your Twitter account, etc., if people want to catch up with you with the podcast and the details of the program on the website. We'll come to your story in a moment. Let me introduce my other guest for the moment, Sheridan Voisey. Sheridan, thank you for joining me today.
Good to be with you, Justin. Good to be with you too, Rebecca.
And thanks for coming over from Australia.
You're sort just of, for this show.
Just for this show.
For this
I know.
Show.
Very kind of you.
That's the kind of pull reach that you have, my
well,
friend.
Well, what can I say? What can I say? No, seriously, you've been a broadcaster for a long time in Australia, doing a show primarily called Open House. Which I came across recently, and a fantastic show, kind of a cultural sort of interaction show, faith, life,
and culture
is kind of and a variety of guests, a variety of worldviews represented. That's kind of been a gateway for you into really meeting a whole variety of people and kind of trying to put across the Christian worldview in ways that are relevant and contemporary and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I just love getting involved in these kinds of conversations, whether it be with folks that would disagree with a position that I would hold or with folks that do. So I think, oh gosh, what is it, 18 years or something in radio now, and I think 10 years writing and speaking. And I think the last time we counted it up, it was something like 2,000 guests that I've interviewed over
that
time.
Goodness me, wow.
So everybody from, I don't know, atheists like Alain de Botton to T.D. Jakes, Joel Osteen, and those kinds of folks. I guess from one spectrum of faith / belief to the other. And that means that you learn a lot of lessons, as I know that you would too in this kind of role.
Absolutely. Well, it's great to have a fellow broadcaster over now in the UK, and you've kind of got a fresh start over here. So it's great that one of the first things you've done is pop by our studio, which is very kind of you to
thank
do.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
And I'm looking forward to the discussion that we've got coming up. So kind of conversational, really, in nature today, not so much a sort of to and fro of a debate or a, you know, hard-nosed kind of topic. We're really just exploring in a more general way the whole area of what it means to lose one's faith and how you interact with someone on that basis. And coming back to you, Rebecca, why don't you give us the not too long story, because I want to get us into the issues as well, but give us the short sort of story on what happened, because you were a Christian, you grew up in a Christian family, didn't you?
Sure. Well, I grew up, first of all, my father's a minister, and both my parents now are actually missionaries living on support. So I've grown up in the church. I'd probably say for probably the first 27 years of my life, I was very actively involved. As I said, I grew up as a preacher's kid. I was involved in youth groups and Sunday schools. I went to several mission trips, including one to Haiti, where I was able to help people in a medical mission context. I even went to a couple of Bible colleges. So I knew the faith. I was intimately involved in the faith. I would lead Sunday school classes, give talks. I even baptized several people. So I really felt like I was passionately involved in the church, and I loved God with all of my heart. And when I think about where I came from, where I went from being a believer to where I am now, I don't see it as an overnight experience. It's really a series of small steps. I've always had questions. I've always been motivated by a sense of justice inside of me. So, you know, I've always been the girl to ask the tough questions in the Sunday school classes or with my parents when I would read my devotions at night. And as I started asking these questions, I started to have, you know, these little nagging doubts and pretty soon, the doubt started to be louder than the actual questions, and I started to not be as satisfied with the answers that I was given or the answers that I found on my own. So I found that I started to explore different versions of church. So I started in a fairly conservative environment growing up, but then I started to look for God in other places, and so I went to more liberal mainstream denominations, or I even went to a Pentecostal church for a while there. And then I started to explore the emerging church to see if I could find a connection there. And I finally ended up at a house church, which is a really small group of believers gathering to study the scriptures and to learn there. And I just found that it was a really long process. And I found that rather than saying I lost my faith, I found that I was slowly rejecting parts of faith that I couldn't understand or that were dissatisfying for me in terms of the moral lessons that they were teaching. So I eventually found myself letting go slowly. I let go of the doctrine of the inerrancy of Scripture, for example, until I finally found myself looking at my belief system and I realized I'm a deist. At most, I can say there could be a God, but I no longer believe that there's this intervening personal God. And when I got to that point, I finally had a heart-to-heart and I just thought, you know, I'm actually an atheist because I'm not even sure there is a supernatural being. And it was scary to say, in all honesty, because I grew up knowing that atheist was this horrible concept of these evil people who, you know, Satan worshippers and all these other misconceptions. But when I was able to be honest with myself, I realized it was more important for me to admit that I'm actually not a believer, and that's okay, and I'm actually doing quite well. So that's a bit of the highlights. There's also, you know, there's lots of little side stories about where I've come from, but really it was just a long process and of just rejecting the faith until it's getting to the point where I am today.
Well, we'll come back to that. I mean, one aspect of this that interests me in a sense is that you are, when you describe yourself as an apostate,
which kind of has a overtones of fanatical Islamic sort of overtones almost. You don't often use that word in terms of a Christian losing their faith, but you describe that in terms of the way you feel almost with your family, who obviously are all still very connected with the church. Your dad, I think, is a minister, and you have various relatives who are involved in Christian ministry. So you sort of feel like you're a bit of a black sheep now in the fold, as it were?
Oh, for sure. And one thing I'd like to make sure your listeners recognize is just how difficult it is for someone to go through this process and then having not only to admit to themselves that they're no longer a believer, but having to admit to their family and people they love who are still in the faith that they're not a believer. Because I do feel like I'm a black sheep. I know that I've disappointed my parents. I know that I'm not who they wanted me to be. And that's a really heavy burden for someone to carry. So it's a very tough decision to come to. So yeah, it's definitely hard.
Mm-hmm. Sheridan, how do you respond to Rebecca's story?
Yeah, with a lot of pathos. just listening to, I mean, one of the things that straight away stands out from your story, Rebecca, is just the sheer degree of effort, actually, that you were putting into this whole search. And this wasn't just like an overnight thing where you decided, this just isn't working for me. I'm just going to give it all in. I mean, obviously, there was a real journey, actually, that you went on, trying to kind of, I guess, maintain faith with the amount of kind of churches that you went to and everything. Would you say, have you given up the whole idea at all that there could be a creator or some sort of supernatural being out there? Is that completely gone now as an option?
No, definitely not. Like there's that saying that there's a faith that seeks understanding. And for the longest time, I held on to that faith, and I understood the world through my faith. But now I feel like that understanding is more informing my faith. So I really hold on to knowledge now, and I don't ever want to get to the point where I feel like I am closed off from all possibilities of there being a God. But I'm also not as persuaded by, anecdotal evidence or evidence that isn't necessarily verifiable. I feel like I have a higher standard now for that understanding than I did before when I was a believer.
And as you were getting around to those other churches, did you find a safe place to be able to ask the kinds of questions that obviously were going on and simmering in your heart and your soul? Were you able to find, a safe place to kind of air those questions?
For the most part. I mean, there of course were some negative experiences, but I think you'd find in any human activity, you're going to find the good and the bad. But for the most part, I did. It was just really, it wasn't necessarily the environment I was asking the questions in. It was the quality of the answers that I was receiving in response to my questions.
I mean, was it purely intellectual doubts that were the, as it were, you would see as the root of this, Rebecca? Were there bad experiences at all in church situations, pastoral situations, which kind of made you think, well, Christianity isn't all it's cracked up to be on that level either? I'd just be interested to know whether it was a combination of things.
Oh, sure. It's definitely a combination. There were some negative experiences in the church, but there also, there were definitely intellectual conflicts that I had to deal with, but there are also quite a few emotional problems too. And I'm sure Sheridan and you too, Justin, are familiar with the atheists' motivation to discuss the problem of evil and how the problem of evil for so many atheists is really what turns them off from the whole idea of a personal intervening God. And for me, as I said earlier, because I was so motivated by this sense of justice that I feel like I've had since I was a young girl, I had a really hard time reconciling the idea of this loving, personal, caring, omnibenevolent God with all the natural disasters I saw in the world in addition to all the human disasters. It was just, it became too hard for me. It became too much of a burden for me to contort my theology to fit in with how I felt inside. And I've eventually just had to give it up.
So it really was the problem of pain that was kind of the kind of key turning point, I guess, the key issue that the others maybe revolved around?
I think so, because I remember growing up in the church and reading these passages of genocide in the Old Testament and really having a hard time struggling with that and struggling with the idea that such an act could be justified and even commanded by a God. And I understand the whole notion of the New Testament covenant and how we no longer hold true, well, not no hold true, but we don't see the Old Testament passages as necessarily moralistic texts. But I never was satisfied with people trying to explain the ethical justifications of the genocides. And not only that, but then we have the whole notion of hell in the New Testament. I always struggled with that. I never quite understood the reasons for that particular doctrine. So it became a real big burden for me to have to rationalize these painful, unethical, in a sense, doctrines as a believer. So that's one reason, another reason why I let go of the faith.
Okay, so there was pain, there was the issue of hell, and then the Old Testament conquest passages, if you want to put it like that. Was there a turning point? Like, was there a particular moment where you got to the stage where you said, okay, that's the final straw? Was it an experience, or was it one day you just sat down and said, that's it? Or was it a discussion that you had, or what? What was the kind of turning point where you said, okay, well, now I do have to actually own up and fess up to my folks and everybody that really this is who I am?
Well, you know, maybe it was the birth of my daughter, because my daughter was born about 4 years ago. And I realized that I needed to start, in a sense, growing up and in standing up for who I was, even though it's a difficult thing. And I knew it would be a very difficult transition for my family and some of my friends to accept me as this non-believer. But I knew for her sake that I wanted to model for her integrity, and I wanted to be someone of integrity. So I didn't want to play the game anymore. I wanted to be honest with myself and then have to deal with those repercussions, because it was so much better for me to be out in the open than hidden literally in the closet when it came to my disbelief.
Mm. It's ironic in a sense, because I often see the opposite sort of situation, where often it's at the point where people have children that they come back to church having maybe left it for quite a long time, because they conversely want to feel that they are giving their children some kind of a foundation of faith, which they suddenly start to have this feeling that, oh, I need more in my life than I think I have at the moment.
And for some people, it's the miracle of life too, isn't it?
Well, there's that, exactly. Yeah,
look at this in front of me.
All the feelings that it brings. But obviously, it kind of worked in an opposite direction for you, Rebecca. I mean, maybe we could just talk briefly about the issues that you came up against there, Rebecca. I mean, you say that justice, you know, your sense of justice has always been something that you then struggle to reconcile God and the problem of suffering with. I mean, what I always feel a little like, and when an atheist says that, is that, well, if fair enough, you may feel the problem of suffering is too great an anomaly when it comes to a loving God to allow you to believe that God, but you don't then get to a position where you're then reconciled with the injustice in the world. The injustice in the world is just a bare fact then, which unfortunately there's nothing you can do. There's no, at least on a Christian understanding as I see it, there will be an ultimate justice. All the wrongs will be righted, and every, you know, God will, you know, justice will be done, as it were. That is the ultimate kind of hope of Christianity. Whereas, of course, on atheism, there is no overriding purpose. We may end up in a situation where great injustices are never righted. And to me, that for me is something that I find quite difficult about atheism, this sense that you are never in any sense guaranteed the future of justice that we all sort of long for somehow in our heart.
Well, you're absolutely right. That's something I've had to accept, in all honesty, because and it sounds bad for me to say this now, but I like the theory of some people suffering for all eternity, because there are some people on this planet that have done such horrific things that there's a part of me that thinks, you know what, they deserve to be held accountable in some type of eternal context. But, you know, as an atheist, I have to recognize that just because I want something to be true, just because I crave that ultimate justice and to have these wrongs righted, that wishful thinking doesn't necessarily make it so. And so I have to accept that as an atheist, it's my responsibility to do the best that I can here and now so that we don't have to have these horrific wrongs that require some type of eternal, omnipotent God to judge. We, as human beings in this society, we need to work together to right the wrongs that we can. And for the wrongs we can't right, it's not enough for us just to wish for them to be righted at some point. Because for me, that's a false hope. And as much as I'd like to believe it, I can't.
I mean, the question then that often springs to mind on that level is, does atheism, in that sense, provide the impetus to do that. For me, when I look at around the world and look at the places where there are injustices in the world, I see a lot of Christians going there and doing those things. And you did it yourself. You went on the mission trip to Haiti. You did the things. And I don't tend to as much, though, of course, there are exceptions always with these things, see that humanistic atheism drives people to that kind of wanting to put the injustices of the world right. I'm not sure that it has quite the driving impetus that Christianity seems to engender in many people to go and make a difference in the world. You may disagree with that, Rebecca.
No, well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I suppose I should give a point of clarification here. I do identify myself as an atheist, but I don't see atheism itself as a worldview necessarily. Atheism is really essentially the answer to one question. Do you have a belief in the supernatural? Do you hold a theistic belief? And I would say, no, I don't. That makes me an atheist. But I'm so much more than just an atheist. I'm also a humanist. I'm also a feminist. I'm also so many other belief systems and ideologies that I can hold on to that are positive and that do affect change in the world. So it's interesting you bring that up in terms of, are there, you know, these atheist hospitals or humanist hospitals out there? I hear that quite a bit. And there are. Granted, atheism and humanism, non-believers are definitely in the minority. So we don't have the numbers necessarily to hold a candle to in terms of the amount of the religious. And I'm the kind of non-believer that totally supports believers going out there and helping others. I have problems, of course, when we have proselytization, you know, tied on to that, when we have to give a spiritual message in as we give that assistance. But there are several agencies out there where non-believers do rally together. Look at the institution of Kiva, for example, kiva.org. That's a micro-lending organization online. And if you go on to that website, you'll see that the number one group contributor in terms of the amount of money given to support people in developing countries is the atheist agnostic group. So that's just one small example of, we are out there. We don't have the numbers necessarily, but we're motivated more by these humanistic reasons than we are necessarily by a compelling reason to serve some type of supernatural deity who commands us to be good to others.
Okay. So humanism would probably be your main, operating worldview then? That would be, like you said, the main motivator rather than atheism?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So another question would be, well, why be good to others anyway? Now, I think that there can be some really good answers that come out of humanism for that question. But one question would have to be, why anyway? If humans are the kind of be-all and end-all, kind of why should we be good to others?
Oh, that's an excellent question. One of the reasons why I myself am personally motivated, and I guess I should have the disclaimer that I really can only speak for myself here when I give these answers. I'm not speaking for all humanists or all atheists here. But the reason why I myself am good to others and several other people that I know, it all comes down to this ethic of reciprocity. You know, I want to be good to others because I want others to be good to me. I don't want to have pain in my life, so I'm going to do my best not to cause pain in others. And if you really look down at the core system, the core ethical systems of the world, it really boils down to that golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And that is a motivating factor for me. Like, I would much rather say, just have someone say to me, they're being good to me because of that, rather than they're being good to me because their God commands them to be good to me.
Okay. I think that's really honest, what you've actually just said there. It's basically down to reciprocity. Of course, that brings major questions when it comes to the issue of love. And the issue of, altruism that is given in a context where you may never actually get anything back in return.
And I was going to add to that, Rebecca, that yes, there are, you know, this is a common maxim around the world, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I mean, I do feel, though, that Jesus went one step further when he said, love your enemies, do good to those that hate you. And in a sense, modeled that himself, if you like, in the big story of this idea that God himself comes to be a servant, not for his own gain, but purely for his love of others. I mean, for me, that is the grand claim of Christianity, that it's actually bigger than do it so that, you know, you're going to be covered as well. If everyone does this to each other, then we all know we're going to be. It's actually not self-serving in that way. It's very much actually not thinking about myself and putting someone else first. And there's no real in a sense, moral drive. There's no driver for that that I can see necessarily on a humanist model. It does have to be kind of reciprocal in the way you've described. Would that be fair?
In a sense, but when we talk about the reciprocal nature of morality, I'm not necessarily talking about direct benefit directly back to me. So I'm not always good to others because I expect a direct result that's going to be in my benefit. I mean, it could be a much larger scale in terms of bettering society or bettering the environment that I'm in, for example. So I mean, and I can appreciate the fact that, you know, that you hold on to this system of faith that sees this as an ultimate sacrifice. But then again, that I also had lots of questions involved with Christ's sacrifice and how really altruistic was it when it came to him dying on the cross, because there's a whole bunch of theology there that I still can't wrap my head around. So while I can appreciate someone else seeing that as a model, I don't necessarily see that myself as something that I would hold on to as being ethical or good.
So, Rebecca, coming back to you, and I'd like to get back to some of those things that we'd started out talking about earlier on in the program, but you emailed me an article that caught your attention. This was written by Alice Wright, who blogged on the way that her life has changed since about a year and a half ago her husband revealed that he no longer shared her Christian faith. And it was a strange moment in our relationship, she writes. And when he first came out to me as an atheist, I made some horribly wrong assumptions. But she's learned some lessons, and she kind of lists some of them in this blog article. She says, one, please don't assume that atheists are evil. Secondly, please don't assume it's just a phase. Please don't say it takes just as much faith to be an atheist as it does to be a Christian. Fourthly, please don't assume that they weren't really saved before they became an atheist. And fifth, please don't assume that they're unhappy. Did any of those ring bells with you? Is that the kind of response that people have given to you since you've come out as an atheist?
Oh, for sure. When I read that article, so much of it resonated with me. I think I figured personally I've maybe experienced 4 out of 5 of those reactions between various family members and friends of mine that are believers, and in reaction to my coming out as a non-believer.
I mean, when it comes to the one about don't assume they weren't really saved for the, we've had, you know, former Christians on this show before, and that's something that the listeners often suggest afterwards. They say, oh, well, they can't really have been a Christian, you know, to and that might slightly be because very often they are so, as it were, on the other end of the spectrum. And in a way, that's interesting about your story, is that you've kind of gone from being very ardent Christian to now writing atheist blogs, you know, doing the atheist meetups, the secular communities and whatever. I mean, in a sense, why the big swing to the other side? And that may be where some people are coming from when they say, you know, well, they've obviously rejected something that they didn't really hold on to in the first place, if they can go that far in the other direction. I wonder if that's where it's coming from.
No, for sure. And I try to understand personally why they would say such a thing, because really, if you look at the implications behind that, you were never a real authentic believer in the first place. There's so many implications on my own integrity when someone says that. So the first 27 years of my life, I was basically living a lie. And it's interesting because there's a verse in the Bible that says, by their fruits you shall know that they're believers. And I had those fruits. Like, I was out there, I attended Bible college, I baptized people, I taught the gospel, I knew the gospel. But as I said in the first half of the program, it was these small steps away from faith. And so you characterize this, Justin, as a big swing, but it really wasn't that big swing. It was that series of steps slowly away until I realized I wasn't. So I understand when believers say to me, you never were a real Christian, because in a way I see that as a type of coping mechanism for them, because it comforts them to think, I can never do that. I never want to be an atheist. And so if I tell her she was never a real Christian in the first place, that means I won't have that chance of losing my own faith. And so I understand that, but I just would hope that people would also understand the implications of what it is they're saying. I'm not offended at the fact that you don't think I'm a Christian. I'm offended at the fact that you thought that I had no integrity and was just faking it for so long.
I think that's a really brilliant point, and every Christian should be taking everything that Rebecca has just said on board. I mean, theologically and biblically, I actually find it a little bit interesting anyway, because the book of Hebrews talks about people falling away. So theologically, we've still got the opportunity for people who really were committed Christians to actually fall away. So I guess
you hold that intention, though. Another person might bring up that verse about those who went out from us were never part of us. And so, as with many parts of Scripture, there are passages you hold in tension. But
indeed. Yeah. As to whether that passage in John is talking about every single person, or just the people who went out from us that actually weren't Christians. Mm. I just think there is the possibility there. And I think that's why there are warnings. Don't fall away. Don't fall away. It suggests that there is actually the possibility that that's the case. Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right, Rebecca. There's a track record there of your Christian history that suggests that you were there and you were following with all of your heart as much as you could possibly do so. I guess I'm spiraling back to this issue of reciprocity, and then something you talked about in relation to that was Jesus and love, because the only question would be there as to whether it was the kind of, I guess, the Jesus that you understood. Can you describe, I guess, how, apart from Jesus being the sacrifice for sins, how much at a practical level was Jesus, say, preached in your church, or really, really, I guess, a motivating part of your life, his life? And see, I'll give you a bit of context to my question. When I first became a Christian, looking back, I see that not only were the majority of the sermons that I heard, but the majority of my spiritual reading was primarily actually in the epistles. It was out of Paul's writings. It wasn't so much out of the Gospels. It was only in later years that I discovered these Gospels and I discovered the life of Jesus for himself. I don't know whether your experience matches mine, but I think for a number of people it has, where Jesus was only, I guess, presented as the fulfillment of our problem with God, kind of a mechanical savior. I'm a sinner. I need to be facing judgment. Jesus takes the judgment for me. And that was it. Was that your experience? Was yours like mine, or was yours broader?
Well, you see, I had several different church experiences. And so I probably could relate more to what you said in terms of the focus on the epistles and not so much of a focus on Christ when I was maybe my earlier years in the church. But again, as I started to explore, I stopped calling myself a Christian and started calling myself a Jesus follower, right? Because I was so motivated by what he said. You know, there's this whole movement of the red letter Christians, you know, people who really look to Jesus as the basis of their theology. So I did take part in that. But even so, there's still, again, those nagging passages, even passages that Jesus has in the Gospels that still were hard. Some of them were hard for me to reconcile. So I can appreciate what your point, though, for sure.
Yes, yeah. So where did Jesus disappoint you?
Well, you know, there are several passages that I've struggled with. I mean, again, the whole notion of hell, you know, there's a lot of passages Christ has in the Gospels where he emphasizes this place of hell. And I understand the notion of Gehenna and what is he talking about when he talks about hell. But just the idea of itself was troublesome for me. There's the passage where he talks about how you have to, you know, hate your family and follow me, like leave everyone behind and follow me. That's also worrisome. And, you know, there was this one story, I think I can't remember where it is in the Gospels, but it was a story where this woman was really sick and she had to come to Jesus for healing. And he called her a dog, I think it was. I think was she a Samaritan woman? I'm not exactly sure. But there was one passage there and I didn't understand it. And I didn't really get a good explanation for it. So I'm sure there is probably a theological reason for it. But all these passages eventually add up, and they get me thinking, this may not be the most moral example for me to follow.
Really? So my mind's kind of flirting with ideas there about some of the things you just raised. I mean, when it comes to the Samaritan woman and Jesus calling her a dog, it was actually a little bit of a taunt in terms of a little bit of a play, because it was very well known by everybody around who was listening to both of them discuss that really those two shouldn't have been talking, and that he was saying, look, the gospel is supposed to be given to the Jews first and not to the dogs, because it was well known that Samaritans of the day by the Jews were called dogs. And he's kind of having a bit of a play with her and say, you know, well, you know, everybody calls you dogs and I'm not supposed to talk to you. And then she comes back and says, yes, but even the dogs will take the crumbs that fall from the table. And the result was, of course, that he then said, I haven't seen such faith. So he certainly...
Yeah, I mean, and I have to confess that while I understand at a surface level those passages may appear to make Jesus look a bit harsh or whatever, Rebecca, when I look at the broad sweep of the life of Jesus and the things he did in his context, he was, to my mind, a revolutionary as far as his treatment of women in the conditions of the day, his approach to people outside the Jewish faith, the Samaritan. I mean, he gives the story of the Good Samaritan, which would have been in its context a completely bizarre story where he could even consider that this person was worthy of, you know, respect and treating in the way that he says that. And similarly, his conversation with the woman at the well, the woman of Samaria, again, a really interesting example of Jesus breaking all kinds of social, conditions and reaching out across barriers that existed. I mean, to me, the Jesus I see, when you take the big picture, is certainly this incredible example of someone who pushed back the boundaries of what it meant to love your neighbour, love others as yourself. And surely in that context, isn't it possible to see that some of these smaller parts of passages where he says, whoever doesn't, you know, hate his mother, father, you may need to read into that a certain point he's trying to bring across. He may not literally mean go away and hate your mother and father now, because obviously he doesn't. That would contradict other aspects of what he says at other points in the story.
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, I'm not doubting the fact that the Jesus we read about in the Bible is a moral character and is someone who definitely has very good things to say in many, many places. I used to have a button that said Jesus was a socialist, much to my father's dismay. So I totally embrace that. But I do still have problems with the whole jump from here is a great moral teacher who does have some good things to say, some troubling things to say, some things that do require more interpretation. Making that jump to this is someone who I have to believe on a supernatural level in order for some type of salvation. Because for me, the whole notion of faith really is just irrelevant. It's not necessary. I don't necessarily need to have this faith. I can appreciate the passages in the Bible where Jesus gives good moral teachings, but I don't necessarily need to follow him in order to be the ethical, moral person that I am. That's what it boils down to, I think.
Don't you think that to some degree, though, we still use a little bit of faith in everyday life? Like, perhaps with the big decisions. I mean, marriage has got to be a key one here. You just don't know how this marriage really will end up. There is a certain step of faith in that. You're trusting on the ethical qualities of the person you're about to commit your life to. There's a certain degree of faith involved in, I guess, everyday life, isn't there?
Oh, for sure. But there's also, you know, with the example of marriage, I'm not necessarily entering into a marriage having never personally met my partner, spent time with my partner, actually met and touched my partner. There is faith because I can't necessarily predict the future entirely, but there's also evidence that I can point to that will give me a good predictor of how this relationship will turn out. And so for someone like me who doesn't necessarily acknowledge the whole supernatural realm of things, it's a lot harder for me to make that jump into a relationship with what I see to be an invisible and an essentially almost non-existent being.
You did at one point, presumably, Rebecca, would have said those things that you did have. Would you have said, you know, would you have characterized it as I have a relationship with Jesus Christ? Is that the kind of language you would have used of your Christian life?
Oh, for sure. I would have. Yes.
So in a sense, what were you basing that on? Was it on experiential things? Was it on, you know, I'm just wondering when you were a Christian, what made you believe that you were a Christian? Now that you're not a Christian, what you make of those experiences? Were you just fooling yourself? Was it just a kind of, you know, you so wanted to believe it that you kind of made yourself? What made you a Christian when you were a Christian?
Well, no, and I kind of alluded to this earlier. I saw those experiences as authentic. And a lot of them were experiential. You know, the feeling you get inside when you're worshiping, the notion of wanting to have this relationship. And so I was looking for that confirming evidence that I was in this relationship. But then as these, as I said, as these doubts grew, my criteria for the evidence started to change. And so the evidence that I had was no longer as persuasive as my experience. And I started to question that. I started to do some reading on the workings of the brain and how the brain can influence these spiritual experiences that people have. And that's not to take away from people's experiences. And I hope you don't read that as me saying that, because I understand that these experiences are very real to people. But for me, I started to understand more of the science behind these experiences. And that started to persuade me that these experiences may not have been as real as I initially thought they were.
So, I mean, and some of that research is really fascinating to read. And I think Christians should be reading all of that and actually getting engaged in all of that kind of all of the stuff that's happening there. Because, of course, yeah, sometimes what we, I guess, attribute to the Holy Spirit or some sort of experience with God is actually some sort of emotional experience, some sort of chemistry happening in the brain. We need to be very wise about all of those kinds of things. I guess my question with all of that, though, is if it's just a couple of things come into mind. How can we really trust, though, what we actually know and what we actually believe? How can we trust anything? How can I trust the feelings that I have for my wife? How can I trust the sense of, I can only imagine the kind of feelings that you feel when you look at your children. If all of those can only be reduced down to, you know, chemical experiences and molecules, it's a kind of a, I don't know, a kind of a lonely, cold old life. If it's all down to that. I remember hearing about a husband and wife that were picking up a hitchhiker, and the hitchhiker was on a spiritual quest. He was asking these questions, and this guy who was driving the car happened to be a philosopher. So they had this great conversation. And then the guy who was asking questions said to the philosopher, "So hang on, let me get this straight. You just believe that that love is only just a chemical reaction in the brain. That's all you believe?" And he said, "Yes, that's true." And at that moment, his wife burst into tears. Because if that's all it is, then I don't know.
Yeah, it's the reductionism, I suppose. I mean, what do you think of that, Rebecca? Is that kind of a danger of embracing atheism, that you're embracing a kind of reductionist philosophy of life and emotion and love? Even your sense of justice is actually just, when you boil it down, a particular configuration of atoms in your brain. There is actually no external justice that we all really long for. It's an illusion on atheism.
Well, no, I've actually heard this argument fairly often, and it's one that I've had to think about. You know, if I see this as a chemical reaction, what are the implications of it? And, you know, once I started to learn more about the natural world around me, when I started to look around the earth and around just what was in my immediate vicinity, I started to be more fascinated by it. So there's actually a great quote that Carl Sagan has that really sums up what I think. He says, "If we are matter intricately assembled, is this really demeaning? If there's nothing here but atoms, does that make us less, or does that make matter more?" And for me, that makes matter more. So yeah, if you boil it down, if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty, yeah, there's chemical reactions in my head, but there are also feelings attached to those reactions, and there's an explanation that goes beyond that. So I know we could get down to a really highly philosophical discussion of how do we know what we know, and we'd have to boil down to Descartes saying, "I think, therefore I am." But for me, it's I want to focus more on the tangible. So rather than having this wishful thinking that there's a God that's giving me this and then I need to necessarily look up to the heavens, for me personally, I'd much rather look around me to find these relationships and my thankfulness for the relationships I have here, and not necessarily for ones that I'm not even sure are existing.
It ties into another of these rules about what you should or shouldn't say to an atheist. Please don't say it takes just as much faith to be an atheist as it does to be a Christian. Now, I can imagine that's somewhat galling for an atheist. You know,
it's a bit condescending, isn't it?
That sounds rather condescending. Yeah. But here's where I might take the kernel of that from, which is that atheism, you said, is just a response to a question, do you believe in God? No. But doesn't it also entail rather a lot? Because if there is no God, then that means we live in a purely material universe. And this goes back to what we were just saying, which means that ultimately there is no transcendent reality, you know, to our life. Our life is ultimately, at an ultimate level, simply a very complex configuration of electrons and energy. And, well, one of my key problems with atheism on the back of that is that it kind of puts the boot in on all kinds of things, not just morality and whether, you know, these moral intuitions we seem to have that seem to be transcend society, but even reason itself starts to break down a bit when you ask yourself, how on earth does reason, rationality, arise from something that is by definition irrational? The movement of electrons, it's obviously moves us into very philosophical territory, which, from what you were saying, Rebecca, you were keen not to go too far down that route. But that is the route I go down ultimately. And that's where the faith comes in, if you like, which is that you have to kind of have faith that what we experience, we can trust on atheism, because at an ultimate level, it does break down so much into, a kind of nihilistic sort of, we are actually just complicated arrangements of atoms, and we can wonder at this, but even our wonder is just an electrical chemical reaction in the brain. That for me is kind of where the faith aspect comes in, because I see atheists who kind of have to take it on trust almost that they really are experiencing reality as they see it, and there's no ultimate grounding for that, that they have it right in a sense. I'm probably not explaining this very well, but do you kind of know where I'm coming from?
Oh no, for sure. What's interesting though is how different you and I see this though. You see this as a problem, the fact that I don't have this cosmic implication to my life, and that in some way would diminish the value of my life from a Christian standpoint, and I can appreciate that. But for me, when I switched over, when I became an atheist, if anything, I found that I valued life so much more, which is always so fascinating to me when people accuse atheists of being nihilistic and of having no hope and not being satisfied with life. Because if anything, I see it as far more precious, and I see it as something that I want to embrace every moment of as far as I can, and I want to model that for my friends and family and for my daughter. And I understand that for a lot of people, they need to have that, not necessarily certainty, but they need to have that foundation, the foundation of faith, in order to feel like they can go from that foundation into other aspects of their life. But for me, I'm okay with the uncertainty. I'm okay with not necessarily knowing the answer, but finding out more. So you're right. If we're just atoms, why do we have reason? Why do we have the drive to be altruistic? Why do we have these things? Why? I don't know the answer for that. But for me, to say that God's behind it or that faith's behind it, for me, that's a stopping point, and that's not enough for me anymore.
Is religion a stopping point for you? I mean, is God a stopping point, a kind of easy plug-the-gap kind of answer, or is it different, Sheridan?
I'm very mindful of the whole God of the gaps kind of thing. When we start talking about religion, I find it fascinating that whether you hold to a, quote, religious outlook on life, i.e. one of the great religions or maybe a New Age spirituality or something like that, or whether you don't, all of us are essentially religious. All of us have some degree of religious impulse within us. And I find it very interesting that, say, Alain de Botton, a well-known popular philosopher who's also an atheist, who has actually said in a very fascinating article in Forbes magazine, he said, secularism just doesn't fulfill humans. He's an atheist. Secularism doesn't fulfill human beings. And so he has actually suggested that there needs to be an atheist religion. And this religion would actually make up of things like special feast days to doubt, and saints days that are actually based on kind of humanistic secular role models. He's talked about a whole network of secular cathedrals where one can go in, one can contemplate, quote, the great beyond. So we all have this religious impulse to our lives. And I guess the whole word proof is always a challenge, I think, because it's coming from a very modernistic perspective that says, well, we need to actually, you know, categorize it. We need to pull it out. We need to be able to feel it, touch it, dissect it. We can't prove love in that regard, apart from, I guess, if you want to say that it's just chemical reactions. But I think the Christian faith, for me, makes the best sense out of all of the kind of things that we've been talking about. So the kind of questions you were saying you don't know the answers to, Rebecca, and by the way, I've still got questions to my faith too that I'm still working through. But if you have that starting point that we are made in the image of God, that even those people who don't actually hold to any religious outlook overtly are still made in the image of God, then altruism actually does kind of make sense, that there is that sense where there is some sort of motivating force in us because we're actually made in the image of somebody who, by his very nature, actually wants to self-give. And it makes sense of morality because, again, there is that kind of ethical base if the whole world is somehow a reflection of the Creator, of his personality. And please, I'm using his because I want to suggest a personal being, not a man. But if that is the case, then it makes sense that we actually do have a moral framework that actually can transcend all cultures. We found that in the work of Professor Brown over in the US and other theorists as well. It makes sense of evil because then we can judge evil against a kind of a basis of good. And it makes sense that that humans do have a latent sense of hope. And the worst thing, of course, is when that hope dies. And I'm just not too sure whether the worldview of, say, just secularism, naturalism, chemical reactions in my brain really gives an answer to the person who is suicidal, who actually says, I can't feel those feelings anymore. I don't have that kind of chemical reaction happening anymore. I'm not getting any reciprocal benefit from the love that I'm giving to other people. Why don't I just end my life if I'm not getting anything back? But from the Christian perspective, you say you're still loved, even if everybody around you hates you. There's still somebody who's there.
We're going to have to take a quick break again.
I'm preaching, aren't I?
You've turned into your preacher mode here. But no, Rebecca, I'm sure, will want to respond as well.
Indeed.
You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. My guests today are former Christian Rebecca Benich, and she's on the line from Canada, and we've been conversing with her in the company of Sheridan Voysey, who's Australian, a writer, speaker and broadcaster. More on him in just a moment's time. Do stay tuned.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Big thanks to both my guests, both completely new to the programme today. Sheridan Voysey has been joining me here in the studio. He's a writer, speaker and broadcaster on contemporary spirituality. He's just moved over to the UK from Australia, where he hosted a regular show called Open House on the radio over there. He's kind of setting up base here, though, and all kinds of interesting projects in the pipeline from him. So I'm sure you'll be hearing more in due course. Rebecca Benich has been on the line from Canada. She's from the US originally, but moved out to Canada, but significantly was a Christian up to the age of about 27, then lost her faith. And we've been hearing about that journey for her, and we've been dialoguing on why, the reasons behind that, kind of what she now believes and how she views her former life as a Christian. And Sheridan's been kind of leading some of the questions on that front. Kind of where we finished up there, Rebecca, was Sheridan suggesting, that the story of Christianity gives this overall hope. It kind of answers what you might call the ultimate longings that appear to be there in the human heart. And we all acknowledge these longings, whether atheist or Christian. You acknowledge this need to see from the outset. You talked about this innate sense of justice that you felt. And I questioned then, will you ever see that sense of justice answered? Because on atheism, there's nothing at all to suggest that it will be. At least on Christianity, you have this story that says it will be. And you've said, well, we just have to be realistic about this. But in a sense, the question that sparked in me when Sheridan was speaking there was, isn't it all an illusion at the end of the day? This isn't an argument for God, but this is just the way it is on atheism. The universe will at some point run out of energy and everything will just return to a state of very kind of, expansive matter. You and I will no longer be here. Nothing we ever did will really be relevant in any way. That's kind of the end game of atheism, and that's why perhaps people talk about the nihilism of atheism, whatever good things and emotions we can talk about in it currently. There is a kind of ultimate illusoriness to all of our endeavours and that sort of thing. What's your response to that, Rebecca? Because I think for a lot of people, that will be where they're coming from when they say Christianity grounds a kind of sense of hope, a kind of ultimate answers that atheism can't give to those kinds of longings of the human soul.
Well, right. Well, I don't think atheism has ultimate answers necessarily. It's never claimed to hold those. And really, atheism itself, as I said earlier, isn't a type of philosophy to hold on to. But going back to your question, Justin, and what Sheridan said earlier, we are able to find meaning in this life. And so I think a lot of people have this idea of atheism as this cold, scientific, unfeeling way of approaching the world. And that's just not the case. As I said earlier, I consider myself mainly to be a humanist. Atheism is just, you know, one of those side questions that I answer. But I also see the value and importance of having ritual and community. Sheridan talked about this study that was written by this scholar saying that we need to have some type of atheistic religion. Well, I agree. Like, I wouldn't call it religion necessarily, but I think there's such a need to mark human events in life. And so I actually am trained as a celebrant because I'm trained to help people commemorate these moments, because these moments don't belong only to the religious. And I'm not saying you think that, but I think that we need to take that time and effort to value what we're doing here and to commemorate those moments and also to build that sense of community. And so that, I think that's one reason why I find myself content as a non-believer, because I'm able to find those moments of ceremony and ritual. And I'm able to find that rich community that I had in the church, but I no longer have to subscribe to a theology or a dogma that I no longer can intellectually support.
Would you be just as accepted amongst your atheist groups, though, if you became a Christian again?
Some people know, and I don't agree with those people, obviously, because I think it's important to maintain a good relationship with believers. And the only line I draw personally is when someone's belief system infringes on someone else. And so if your belief system harms the human rights of someone else, well, then I'm going to speak up and I may be negative. Or if I find that your belief system's hurting you in some way. But other than that, I'm not, I guess you would call me a peaceful atheist. I'm not necessarily out there to deconvert others.
It's been fascinating talking with you. I mean, just as we come to the conclusion of the program, Sheridan, I mean, when it comes to the way we do as Christians interact with atheists, particularly atheists who have had a Christian sort of background, do you think there are any kind of good things you would suggest, you know, ways of doing that that aren't going to be offensive, be patronizing, condescending, whatever? What would be your general take on it?
Yeah, well, I think some of these have already been modelled by Rebecca in reaching out and actually having a conversation with those people that she philosophically disagrees with, and also modelled by yourself, my friend, in this kind of program where you actually welcome all sorts of people onto it from all sorts of ways of life. So, I mean, five quick points. Firstly would be just listen. If your family member comes to you and says, you know, I no longer believe and you're a Christian, it's going to feel like, you know, you've just heard about the divorce of the greatest couple you ever knew. Of course, that's the nature of it. You're going to be shocked. There's going to be, but listen like they are your closest brother, sister, daughter, as they probably are if they come and have this conversation. And I would also, these points, I guess I'd also make for the atheists on the other side too. It'd be nice also if we could listen, just listen to each other, hear the stories, where have we come from, and listen to some of the questions that we have too. Secondly, gentleness and respect always comes to mind. Christians listening will straight away know where I got that from, 1 Peter, where Peter is talking to the church and saying, yeah, be prepared to defend your faith, but always do this with gentleness and respect, always. And so some of the things that we were talking about before, don't condescend and don't kind of think that, yeah, well, straight away your non-Christian person, your now atheist family member or friend is suddenly going to be out there saying horrible things and doing horrible things. Gentleness and respect, that also goes to the kind of words that we use about each other in conversations and also online. I have seen some really disappointing discussions online from Christians talking about atheists in some of the words that they've actually used. We really shouldn't be using names. We shouldn't be name-calling. We shouldn't be ridiculing. We shouldn't be saying they're shallow. We shouldn't be saying that they're godless, they're so-and-so and so-and-so. And I would also ask, that if at all possible, that the new atheist community would also follow suit. I mean, just as I was looking at some websites on the way in today, I was seeing some horrific things being said about Christians. And in fact, on one website, you know, one of our well-known apologists was actually called, quote, and excuse my French, the asshole apologist. Now, that's not the way to have a conversation with other people. I mean, these are people that they're kind of family members. They're people that we love. So let's stop the name calling. Number three would definitely be apologize if you have in any way as a Christian not represented Christ well to this person that has just come and said to you that they no longer believe. Maybe we have fallen short. Maybe we have not provided a place where this person could honestly come and have their deep questions like Rebecca has. Deep questions about the faith. We've got to provide that kind of welcoming place and apologize where we have actually fallen. Maybe we've name-called people who are atheists. Let's not be part of that. We need to apologize. Four would be don't assume that atheists can't do good. I think that's come out very well from Rebecca and from some of the points that we've already said. If the doctrine of humanity and creation means anything, it means that humans are made in the image of God. And even those people who don't believe are still made in that image. They can still do good. They can still do altruistic things. I would even suggest even without some sort of reciprocal benefit as well. And also, so I'd also ask for our atheist friends that they could also suggest that maybe we could do some good as well. Again, some of the stuff that I've read online almost paints the Christians out to be the devil worshippers. And fifthly would be just love. I mean, love is the key when it comes to the Christian life, and to love, 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 love.
Thank you very much, Sheridan. Rebecca, anything you'd like to leave us with as we finish up today?
Well, no, I just appreciate this opportunity to talk, and I hope that I haven't come across as a so-called angry atheist. I know that's a label that's often tossed around for people who don't necessarily share the same belief or ideology as others. And I just hope that the dialogue channels will stay open, and that if you yourself have a family member in your life who is an apostate, someone who has rejected the faith, not necessarily lost the faith, but as I say, rejected the faith, that you will do those five steps that Sheridan just mentioned. Because I appreciate the goodwill that he showed in showing this and giving us those steps. And I appreciate the goodwill of this show in opening up the dialogue channels.
Well, it's been great to have the dialogue with you today, Rebecca. I always wish we had more time because there were so many areas that we raised, but we never really got to discussing it in any depth. If you want to hear more in the kind of areas that we did talk about today, then why not browse through the archives of Unbelievable? You can find a vast array of past programs at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. There's also a tab you'll find there called Topics, and if you're particularly interested in a particular aspect, perhaps programs on the Bible, programs on philosophy, programs on ethics, then why not check that out, and you'll find a way of interacting with the programs thematically so that you can choose exactly the type of program you want to listen to. But thank you for being such a regular listener yourself, Rebecca, and getting in touch, and it's been great to touch base and have this conversation. And I go well in the meantime, and thank you for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you with me. And thanks to you, Sheridan, for being with us today.
Thank you for the invite, mate. It's been great.
I'm sure we'll have you back at some point in the not too distant future.
You've been listening to a classic replay edition of Unbelievable. Do get in touch with your thoughts. You can do that at our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you'll find resources, the back catalogue, and ways to support the show into 2022. Thanks for being with us for the journey. See you next time.